I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. For parents of children with developmental disabilities, a question that haunts many is, what will happen to my child when I'm gone? Who will watch over him or her? Where will my child live? Can he or she hold a job? Today, we discuss options for personal, financial, and healthcare decision-making as children with developmental disabilities come of age. Joining us is Susan Senator. She's a mother of three boys. Her adult son, Nat, was diagnosed with autism at age three. Her books include Making Peace with Autism, The Autism Mom Survival Guide, and her latest book is Autism Adulthood, Insights and Creative Strategies for a Fulfilling Life. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Also in studio with us is attorney Fred Misolo, considered one of the nation's leading elder law and special needs attorney. He focuses on areas of elder law, special needs planning, estate planning, and trust administration, guardianship, and adult service advocacy. Welcome back to you as well.
Nice to be here, Mindy.
Also, as many listeners know, I also have a daughter with developmental disabilities. And for full disclosure, Fred did do my daughter's special needs trust following a program we did years ago on this subject. So I guess we should start with examples of what developmental disabilities include. Autism, Down syndrome, brain injury. I mean, there's a long list.
Right. So intellectual disability is, really a definition that with respect to DDS is clinical in nature, that it meets a federal the AIDD definition. But when you look at developmental disability, it includes autism, it includes Smith-Magenis, it includes Asperger's, all sorts of conditions which impact an ability to relate to other people and be self-sufficient. I would have to say, though, that the definition is not clinical, but I think more social. When it comes to the work that I do as a trust and estate lawyer, is helping families plan the future for their son or daughter. And it may include a guardianship, but that is really something that we think of as the last alternative, not the first alternative. We look at self-sufficiency in terms of employment, relationships. So to answer your question, I don't think intellectual disability, developmental disability, is a definition that is sort of defined clinically, but more socially, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And so when we talk about children with developmental disabilities coming of age, that's either when they turn 22 or graduate high school. And this is a big deal because these children often have IEPs, individual education plans, and the programs or services that they're receiving in school under those IEPs go away at the age of 22. So if you don't plan ahead, this can be devastating.
That's right. You have to start talking about it. Well, legally by age 16, but it should be way before that. Even when a child is four, parents, guardians would be, they really should start talking about it, or at least thinking about what their child might be able to do in life as an adult.
The age of emancipation in Massachusetts is 18, and the age of leaving special education is 22. So when Susan talks about needing to plan for 16, we're really looking at what are the decisions that people need to be making when their son or daughter is reaching the age of emancipation at 18. Because at that time, parents really don't have any rights to make decisions on behalf of their son or daughter. They're no longer the natural guardians. And so there's a range of alternatives that they need to consider. And so there's an individual transition plan that gets established under what was called the 688 program to enable school districts and parents to begin to plan the transition to adult services that doesn't happen from a practical perspective until age 22 when the special education entitlement ends. But at age 18 is when a lot of things happen. Eligibility for supplemental security income. That automatically, if you get eligible for that, you're then on Medicaid or MassHealth. There's applications to the Department of Developmental Services or DMH. They accept applications at age 18, typically don't provide services until 22. So, I think Susan's absolutely right. Beginning at 15, 16, beginning to think about this, is very, very important.
Yeah. I think sometimes the teachers are, I know in my case, it's something I did not think of, you know, when my daughter was younger, but the school did. And they said, you know, you really need to start thinking about this. And I think, you know, they're great with helping and guiding a lot of the school systems, but not all.
It's true. And not all the school systems get there at all. So what I wrote the book thinking parents need to think in terms, like even emotionally, how to envision adulthood. So even if they're not going and taking care of actual documents and applications for adulthood, they at least need to get behind the concept of their child, their developmentally delayed child, having an adult life someday, and just not being scared of that.
Mm-hmm, right. And I guess we should talk about, you know, with autism in particular, there's a spectrum. And the same is true for other developmental disabilities. So the ones who are most severe, usually the getting services is not as big of an issue. And then the ones who are higher functioning, you might have, but it's kind of that middle ground, those kids who are in that middle ground who really have a tough time, Fred, getting approved, don't they?
Yeah. So there's scarce resources. And I think one of the major takeaways that you're suggesting, which is, I think, is crucial for families to recognize, is the age of entitlement ends at age 22. I mean, you do have a right to a free public, appropriate public education under the federal law until you're age 22. At age 22, there's a drop-off. It's a cliff. And adult services is based on a triage of who needs the services most. And it's not on, it's basically health and safety. And so a lot of, you know, David Braddock is a sociologist who's been active every year working for the AAIDD, the American Association on Intellectual Developmental Disabilities. He does a national survey of who gets services, where are the services, state by state, and then he does a national composite. 75% of all individuals with intellectual developmental disabilities are supported by their families. So 25% essentially are getting 75% of the resources. So the families are the backbone, right, of supporting their family members with a disability. So there are scarce resources. You're absolutely right. If somebody needs very significant services and supports to keep them healthy and safe, they're probably going to get services. They're probably going to get what's called priority one residential for DDS. The vast majority, however, may get employment services, day supports, but residential is really a patchwork.
Yeah. And we'll talk a little about special needs trust in a moment, but I want to talk about your son Nat for a minute, Susan, because we've talked about, I think you've been here for all the books you've written, and I really support them, because I really feel like you give some really good information to parents. And I'm thinking back to the first book, I think it was the first book, when Nat was small, and you know, people who have kids with autism who are more severe and know how difficult it is to go anywhere, to family events. And I loved him. The one that's standing in my mind is when you were going, I'm not sure which grandparent, but you were going for Thanksgiving, and you would make a little book for Nat to say, okay, here we're going to grandma's house, we're going to have to, and kind of line out what the day would be to help him get through that. Your books are full of little tips like that that I think are so helpful. So tell us a little bit, Nat, so people in the audience know about him.
Okay, so Nat, who's 28 now, has fairly severe autism, some cognitive delay, communication issues, trouble, difficulty talking. He's great physically, gross motor, all that, and attending to things. So he's on the end of the spectrum where he did get residential funding, as Fred was talking about. In terms of those little books, those are just social stories. That's the method it's called. And we still do that for him. We try to spell out what's going to happen at this new event, what it will feel like to him, what he can do and what he maybe shouldn't do, how it will end. Mm-hmm. So that and that's so important to him, as well as schedules and calendars.
Yeah. And another point that you bring up, I think, is important, is as parents, you really know your kids better than anybody else. And now where Nat isn't very communicative, you have to read the signs to kind of sort of tell what he's happy about, what he's unhappy about, what his moods are. And sometimes you get information, sometimes you don't. Sometimes you don't know what's going on.
Yeah, there's so many ways in which you might not get it. But every parent I know whose child is up and down the autism spectrum has this same problem, because even if there's conversation abilities, there might be a lot of difficulty in actually reading a situation and understanding what's really going on. Mm-hmm. So that, unfortunately, what Fred was talking about, those people in the middle who might not get services, supports, actually really need them, because they're out in the world, mm-hmm. and they're in a lot of potential danger in terms of deciphering situations that are safe or not, just because it's a communication disorder.
Right. Yeah. All right, Fred, so tell us about special needs trusts. What are they, and why do we know about this?
Well, it's amazing that as much as we talk about estate planning for folks, for families who have sons and daughters with intellectual developmental disabilities, I get really discouraged when I hear the statistics that about 25% or less of families actually develop an estate plan. And I think, you know, part of the reason is that life is busy, mm-hmm. and you're focused on just, you know, day to day, week to week, month to month, and you don't really want to think about the future without you involved with your son or daughter's life. And there are some, you know, difficult issues that people need to think about relative to who's going to be managing the funds, who's going to be making decisions, who's going to be there to support. And if the family's not ready to engage in those kinds of conversations and decision making, often they will put off calling me or another attorney in this process. But a special needs trust is basically it's more than a property management tool, but it is. It's set aside to be funded principally when the parents pass away, and to be managed over the course of an individual's life to ensure that a few objectives are met. First, that means-tested welfare-type benefits, that's the backbone of the disability funding, it typically is means-tested, that those government benefits are maintained, but that the funds are managed in a way that promote a rich, wonderful life for the trust beneficiary. It also is established so that there is freedom from exploitation, financial exploitation. And families can pick the trustee, you know, family members sometimes will pick family members, you know, siblings, aunts and uncles to serve as a trustee. They might, we do a lot of co-trustee work with families and professional trustees, you know, so you're managing from the heart and managing from the head. So there are banks and others that can also serve as trustees. But you want to think about the special needs trust that's funded with families' resources upon the death of the parent to be essentially a protective device and a supportive device for the individual over the course of their lifetime.
Yeah. And I'll say, I think another thing people hear, special needs trust, and they think, oh, that's for people who have a whole bunch of money. And really, in reality, it's not. Because if you are getting government benefits, your son or daughter, there's only a certain amount of money they're allowed to have.
Yeah. Currently, the asset resource limitation for supplemental security income and many waiver-based programs, Medicaid waiver programs, is $2,000. And so there is a really imperative to create these types of trusts to ensure that eligibility for those benefits aren't wasted, or you have to spend down those assets to get into other types of more complex types of trusts, like qualified special needs trusts that have a payback provision to Medicaid. But I don't want to get too far down into the weeds.
Yeah, it gets a little bit complicated. All right, so when we look just at the autism numbers over the next decade, an estimated 800,000 children with autism will age out of their school systems and be looking for support services from state and federal government. So it doesn't seem likely, as we're saying already, there isn't enough money to go around to support everyone who needs that help. And waiting lists are really long. So you can see why families are really nervous about the future of their children.
Right. I mean, I think that what families have to do is they have to have a vision of what they want for their child. And even they have to have a vision for worst case scenario. Even if there's no funding, what will we do? So you look into other funding streams. You make friends with other families who have similar children. Mm-hmm. And you think about creating your own, a group home somehow. You think about supplementing an apartment. Section 8, affordable housing. You try to learn about all the different choices that are out there. And even if they aren't there, maybe create something.
Yeah, so we have a lot of creative families in this area who've created like education programs, living situations. We're going to take a break here. 866-999-4626 is our number if you have comments or questions for us this morning. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about children with developmental disabilities reaching adulthood and things we need to think about for planning. In studio with us is Susan Senator. Her latest book is The Autism Mom Survival Guide. Oh, her latest one is Autism Adulthood, Insights and Creative Strategies for a Fulfilling Life. Also in studio with us is attorney Fred Misolo, considered one of the nation's leading elder law and special needs attorneys. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So we're talking about not enough money for all the support services we need for everybody who needs it and being creative. And Susan, you talk about some of these creative ideas families have come up with in your book. So give us a couple of examples.
So I wanted to write about quality of life for people who may not get the funding for residential that they might need. There's still other aspects of your life that you have to consider. So I did a lot of talking to people about daytime pursuit. I talked to one dad out in Indianapolis who, with the ARC of Indiana, created and actually partnering with Marriott, created a teaching hotel where people with developmental disabilities go into the program and are trained in the hospitality industry and in all levels. And when they come out of it, they can get jobs in a hotel. Then on a more personal level, there was a man in a farm residence who he's obsessed with pets and he's obsessed with cement. And he and his caregivers came up with the idea of Pete's Pet Stones, which are basically cemetery stones for your pet. And he has, you know, a website and all that. Another guy I found out about, fascinated and very, very competent in Lego assembly. His dad came up with the idea that he would do, he would put together IKEA furniture. So even though, so this company's called Made by Brad. The young man just goes into the house, puts together the furniture, and that's that. He doesn't have to talk. So there's big and small. One more story I have is this young man who we're friends with, who became fascinated and completely an expert in the duck tours. Mm. So he has memorized all the spiels of the duck tours, and he's become their blogger. So even though he doesn't have a job yet at the helm, he could, I believe, but at least his blog is terrific.
And I think this is something that's common in parents of some of these kids, is we have a tendency to focus on what our kids can't do rather than what they can do. And even those who test really low on cognitive skills, excuse me, you write, if you can get them a job, get them out there, their cognitive abilities improve. And you start the chapter on employment and job training with a quote from Temple Grandin, who I think we all know, one of the first individuals on the autism spectrum to publicly share insights from her personal experience. But she says, start work skills at age 12, run the church website, work in a farmer's market. Let's not get trapped in the autism silo. It's a big spectrum. What would have happened to Einstein and Jobs if they had the autism label? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the key thing we're talking about here, isn't it? Find what skills your kids do have and start with that.
Exactly. And my son, for instance, learned how to put together pizza boxes when he was 15 or 16 at his school. And we found that he's very good at putting things together. And he eventually got a job in a supermarket putting away shopping carts. So he became fairly independent, and he got Worker of the Year from that supermarket. So,
let's talk to Gretchen, who's giving us a call from Marston's Mills. Hi, Gretchen.
Well, good morning. How are you?
Good.
I'm just wondering about funding special needs trusts for someone who's in their 50s already and concerned with parents being elderly and a look-back period. Is that something to worry about? It sounds like you're talking about funding the trusts once parents pass, but I thought you had to do it prior to that. So I'm a little.
You mean setting up? When do you set up the trust? Is that what you're asking, Gretchen?
Yeah, or when you fund it, setting it up, what the deadline is, and funding it. I thought it had to be funded, you know, well in advance of parents passing, without fear of a look back if your parents need long term care.
Right, Gretchen. Thanks for that question. I think it's a really good one because there are competing objectives that you've identified. One is looking at the perhaps long-term care needs of the parents and seeking to protect those assets for the next generation. How do you do that? And that adds a layer of complexity. There is a 5-year look-back period for long-term care benefits if you're seeking MassHealth eligibility. And so any kind of transfers that you want to safeguard for the next generation should be transferred over 5 years. But those are an income-only irrevocable trust, and I really don't want to get too granular on this because it's a very complex area. But you're gifting that money away and no longer have the access to the principal. And so we often will find that parents don't want to relinquish control or ownership over many of their assets during their lifetime because they might need that for their own retirement. They may need to refinance their home to make repairs and maintenance or other aspects of using their assets. So there is a look back period if you're concerned about Medicaid. But when I was speaking earlier about when typically a special needs trust is funded, it is ordinarily funded without regard to any Medicaid planning at the time both parents have died. I will add, and I don't want to spend too much time more on the level of complexity because we could be here for another hour, but there is a perfect storm between the elder law area and the special needs area. One federal statute does allow parents who find themselves needing immediate long-term care for themselves, they can create and fund a Medicaid payback special needs trust that does not have a look back period. I call that the trust of last resort because, you know, the assets are going to be spent down on the parents' nursing home care, and rather than seeing that those assets get spent down, transferring it over for the lifetime of their son or daughter, relative with a disability. The difficulty with that type of trust is that there's a payback provision. When the special needs beneficiary dies, anything left in that trust needs to be paid back to the Division of Medical Assistance. So as you're probably thinking, as you're listening to me, wow, this is an area that's pretty complex and there aren't any cooking cutter approaches. There are situations where you may want to transfer a large sum of money or a sum of money into a 5-year look back type of income only irrevocable trust. There are often many, many reasons not to do that. So it's best to, you know, speak to an attorney, get an individual consultation so you can weigh the advantages and disadvantages your family's facing. What I'd like to do is go back to something Susan said, Mindy,
sure.
About the creativity of families and the resourcefulness of families. You know, the Ark of Massachusetts, the Ark of Cape Cod, the Ark of the United States was a family-generated organization. It started about 60 years ago across the country. It was because families who had sons and daughters with intellectual developmental disabilities didn't like what the state had to offer. There was nothing out there. It was prior to any special education. So the real effective solutions and most of the advancements in disability policy have come from families. It hasn't come from, you know, leaders or government or lawyers. It comes from parents. It comes from families who are living with challenges and saying, I'm not going to put up with what is being offered, I'm going to create opportunities and use my resources, use my family network to make a better life for my son or daughter.
Yeah, Gretchen, thanks for the phone call. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org, which also goes back to Susan's point about parents with kids who have similar issues getting together. And I think this is true for anything you're dealing with, is kind of comparing notes and going, well, how do you handle this? And, you know, sharing ideas and parents getting together, as you're mentioning, Fred, and creating some of the solutions to these problems or issues. Fred, the other thing I think might be worth mentioning, for a lot of parents who are setting up these special needs trusts, the biggest asset they have is their house. So if you have a special needs trust and you die, does the child, usually that probate process is a really long time. Mm-hmm. If it's in special needs, you don't have to worry about that, correct?
Well, what you want to do is with your estate planning lawyer, ensure that the estate plan documents the trusts, the revocable trust. Sometimes you do credit shelter planning for estate tax reasons. That you want to retitle the house so that it doesn't pass through probate. And, most trust and estate lawyers will make that as part of their estate planning process.
All right. Susan, you also this week have an article in Psychology Today that talks about music instruction. And I found this fascinating because music is it's very beneficial in so many levels. But who thought? And Nat is actually in a band. So
yes.
Tell us about this.
Nat's in a rock band called the Brookline Buds because we are all from Brookline. It's a band of all developmentally disabled adults. It's from the organization MUSE, which stands for Music, Unity, and Social Expansion. And what they do is they cover all sorts of songs, mostly rock. And actually, the musicians choose their songs. Nat, who barely, has trouble speaking, chose songs himself. We got the name Mariah Carey out of him, which really surprised me. But the band plays gigs. For now, they've played at ARC Mass at their annual conference. They have played at various foundations, but pretty soon they're going to start playing open mics in bars around Boston.
Yeah. And you go to the rehearsals. And so tell us what you see happening with the kids in this band.
Every week I attend the rehearsals and I see growth. And, these guys are 22 plus, so their brains are developing still and amazingly. And I've watched people who are almost nonverbal conferring with another musician friend on all kinds of things about, like, playing bass or when to come in with the maracas. There's our guitarist who's learning how to play lead solos. And there's my son who's watching for cues now. The violinist also slowed down his pace to meet another person in the band's pace. So they're really looking at each other, which is extraordinary for people on the autism spectrum. In general, there might be an issue with kind of noticing and another person and what they're thinking and what they need. So these guys in their band are bouncing off of each other.
Yeah. I could see some parents of autistic kids saying, yeah, my kid would never put up with that kind of noise, which is something you thought. Nat, normally loud noises bother him, but he started with the percussion and then kind of gravitated to the microphone. So how surprised were you when he actually got up to that microphone and started singing?
When he moved over to the microphone for Life is a Highway, which is a song he learned when he was like 17, and everybody was just, the mouths dropped open. And we just said, okay, Nat, sing. And out of his mouth came the words, the full words, the lines and lines of lyrics, Life is a Highway. At the time, there wasn't much melody, but that's okay because it kind of goes with the rap style of other songs. And we're just in it to see what happens, basically.
Right. One of the things, and Fred, you touched on this earlier, is we're busy with life and sometimes we kind of, and especially if we're in some sort of denial and we don't want to talk about this. But for families with kids with special needs, it's tough. I mean, every day is a struggle and there's a lot of things going on. And so when you have that kind of daily struggle going on, it's really hard to kind of, and Susan's for you too, is to step back and kind of go, okay, you know, what else could I be doing, you know, to help enrich my child's life? So from both of you, thoughts on being able to step back a little bit and you know, do some of this stuff.
It's always important to be able to actually give yourself a break when you need to and step back and maybe do something else, but come back to it when you can. And I tell people, for instance, you need to be going to conferences, but maybe not, you know, six conferences a year, maybe even one conference that's talking about transition or giving you a resource like Autism Housing Pathways, the ARC conferences. But even if you come out of it with one thing that you've learned, that's good. Give yourself a break and regain your perspective and go back again and talk to the people at the conference and find a mentor and buy them coffee.
Buy them coffee, yeah.
Right. I spend most of my time with families on a day in and day out basis, you know, doing consultations, developing estate plans. And if there's one thread that I sometimes, you know, see is a sense of isolation and a sense that you're doing it on your own. And I think Susan's so absolutely right that, you know, reach out to families who have similar concerns and interests that you do. You're not alone. There are some wonderful resources, Susan included. The ARC, local, both regional and state, and other parent groups, you know, reach out. You're not alone, and there are some paths to follow.
Can I just one resource? Special Olympics. You know, find your local one, and even if your child is not participating, maybe just hang out at the sidelines and start chatting up the parents that are there or the adults, the adult athletes. Find out what they're doing. What did they do? Where are they living?
I'm glad you said that, because that to me was a real eye opener. My daughter did horseback riding, and when she got into the competition there, they had to do a course, and they had to memorize this, obstacle course and these things, and I thought, sequencing, there's absolutely no way she's going to be able to do that. They walked through it once. She aced it. I was blown away. So your kids will amaze you on the things that you don't think they're capable of doing, but in some situations are able to do.
Absolutely. Yeah,
you can't underestimate, overstate the importance Special Olympics have had in the lives of folks with disabilities and their parents. It's just been a tremendous, now they're looking at integrated games, and it's really international in scope. And I'm glad you said that, because it gives me an opportunity to say I'm running for Special Olympics in the Falmouth Road Race in August. More like walking.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626 if you'd like to join the conversation. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about children with developmental disabilities reaching adulthood and how to plan for that. In studio with us is Susan Senator, author of Autism Adulthood Insights and Creative Strategies for a Fulfilling Life, and attorney Fred Misolo, who specializes in elder and special needs law. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Since before the break, you mentioned autism housing pathways, and it made me think about housing. And you know, this huge wait list, you know, for group. There's lots of options, I think, that people don't know about for, you know, depending on what the disabilities are. But autism housing pathways, they're amazing. I think they know everything, and they really are very creative in how they find housing.
They are. And the founder, Kathy Boyle, knows everything and everyone in the state, the laws. She also has gotten it so that there are training videos for staff, videos made by parents and for parents. And also she's found an adapted curriculum for self-determination, so that no matter what intellectual level an adult with disabilities might be on, they can still plan their own housing, which is so important, and that's the law, and that's really as it should be. There's also Cheryl Ryan Chan, who does person-centered planning, and this is a way that you can get the goals of the individual supported by not only the family, not only by the siblings, but also anybody important in this person's life can have a role in their life as the parents age and maybe can't do it anymore. So it's not just on the siblings. It's on, you create a community. She calls it a circle of friends, yeah. Circle of supporters.
I just want to say, friend Kathy Boyle on Facebook, because she always has these great little resources to think that she's always posting on Facebook. Go ahead, Fred.
So it's a great segue. My law firm is co-sponsoring with Kathy and with Cheryl and with Chris Miller of Miller Mortgage a housing seminar on Saturday, September 29th, up in Marlboro. And if listeners want to log on to the Fletcher Tilton website, there's a registration form there that you can sign up. It'll be about a five-hour training on issues, as Susan talked about. You know, Kathy has models of residential support. Cheryl is terrific around person-centered planning. Chris Miller is a mortgage guy who is the only mortgage originator I know who's very familiar with the FHA loans. That is a special program for folks with kids with disabilities who can get some mortgage financing. Yeah. And we'll be talking about integrating that with their trust and estate plan.
Yeah, and we'll put a link on our website, capeandislands.org, to that when we're a little bit later in the morning. It's not there yet. So talk a little bit about housing options, because they're, you know, and I'm sure, Fred, you get this from families going, you know, my son or daughter's been on a wait list for 8 years, 10. I mean, some of these lists are, the wait times are just incredible.
Yeah.
And families get very, obviously, very frustrated.
So one of the things parents should do is apply for a Section 8 mobile voucher at age 18, either to their regional housing down here in the Cape, it's the Housing Assistance Corporation, or the local housing authority. Individuals with disabilities recognized under the Americans with Disabilities Act are eligible to get a Section 8 voucher. And if you can demonstrate when you get the voucher that you need a reasonable accommodation in order to utilize that voucher. You know, that is, you know, that you can have a family member own a condominium and be the Section 8 landlord. That you need to demonstrate to the local housing authority, the Housing Assistance Corporation, the need for the reasonable accommodation. That one of the accommodations could be, well, you know, a person with a disability really can't navigate the relationship with the landlord. And if that relationship soured, then that person would become homeless. Mm-hmm. So one needs to have a friendly landlord so that you can lease then to a family member. Mm-hmm. So that's an example of what Kathy and I have worked on for families over time, is navigating that. You know, also partnership with families, you know, thinking about working together. There may be families, we had a housing panel several years ago, where one family had resources and the other family didn't. But they got along, their daughters met in early intervention. And so the parents get along very well. And I underscore the need to get along with parents as mm-hmm. well. It's really important that you do your due diligence and you don't get into a situation or a partnership with families that they may not, it may sour.
Yeah, I know. So, yeah, don't get along.
So
I just wanted to add that I think that those town vouchers are project-based Section 8, so people should know that that's another term to look for, that the Section 8 voucher stays with the building and isn't mobile, but it is another way. Towns might develop their own affordable housing, and you might be able to get housing that way. Mm-hmm. There's also a bill on accessory apartments, which would allow families, no matter what the zoning is in their town, to build some kind of apartment, an in-law kind of apartment for their adult child, so that they can have their own independent space. One more thing I wanted to mention was adult family care, which is a Medicaid-based program where even if you don't get residential funding from the state, you might be approved for support for a stipend for a caregiver. If you get approved for, there's various levels of competence.
Right.
So that's another kind of avenue of funding.
Suzanne, I want to talk a little bit about NAT housing and maybe give some direction on how you decide what's going to be best, especially if you have a child like NAT who isn't as communicative, that you know, okay, is he in a group home? Does he want to live alone? And you've tried both. And is that part of the strategy to try different things and see what works best? Or how did you decide what?
I think, like all of us, you have to realize that your adult loved one is not going to live in the same place forever. Most of us move. Things change. So as the parent, you have to be very vigilant and watch for changes in your adult child to see if there's behavior changes, you know, even if there isn't much talking, to really tune in to the possibility that something's not right anymore. Or, you know, you might find something that's even better that you want to switch over your child to. And that's what we've done. We're working on shared living now as opposed to group home, because shared living would be Nat just moving in with caregivers into their home, share their life. And you're out in the much more in the community, and they're paid a stipend. And it works very well when you get the right caregiver.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Right. You have two other sons. So, and you've talked in your books about the relationships between siblings. And I think this is an area where parents sometimes have a bit of guilt because, you know, your special needs child, it takes a lot of your attention. And sometimes the other kids can, you know, feel bad about that.
It's very hard to think about that because your other adult children, the other siblings have their own lives. And you don't want it to be that they were born to take care of their disabled sibling. No, they were not. But they are a resource. I think that it's great for parents to talk about it, to give them choices, to give them a variety of different levels of care and involvement that they might want to have as adults. But you can't just depend on it. You can't depend on the siblings to want to do that. You have to kind of let them have their lives, but keep the conversation going. And hopefully, eventually, they will take part in the care as you start to age.
All right, Fred, this is an issue I'm sure you get with the families who come in and talk to you about.
Yeah, and there's no right answer. It's very, very unique. The one of the more difficult questions comes down as the sort of neurotypical kid gets married and goes off and, you know, has a great life. The parents ask, well, should I be distributing assets at the time of our passing equally or equitably? And so it's real important for families to, you know, talk about that and talk to their lawyer, but also talk amongst themselves, because there may be really good reasons why you may want to disproportionately provide greater amount of resources to the special needs trust to ensure those assets are there for the family member with a disability, knowing that if it is overfunded and all the money isn't spent, the remainder beneficiaries in that trust could be or would be the other children. Mm-hmm. So there's a sort of a safeguard there. At the same time, there's can be resentment, and so we need to, you know, talk to families about not surprising your children about making this decision, but having a conversation about it while they're alert and living and going through the process.
And I guess being aware, Ben, your youngest son was diagnosed with a form of PTSD, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because he grew up he was a real little guy when my oldest was kind of volatile and had aggressive behavior, and we were trying to figure it all out. And Ben was frightened a lot. That's probably the time period that got Nat the residential funding that he needed, because we were no longer able to hold it all together, you know, while Nat was like that. Very difficult decision, but I had to think about Ben too, of course.
Yeah, of course. And I think another thing, I'm going to go back to one of your other books, was the first time you took a vacation without Nat. You felt really guilty about that, guilty for having a good time with the rest of the family. But in hindsight, Nat was also having a good time on his own sort of vacation.
Right. I mean, we tried to make it good for everyone, but of course you can't win when you're a parent. You just always feel guilty. But we went to Colorado. Nat went to a special autism camp in Colorado called Ascendigo, and it was fantastic for him. I knew it would be. And all the, and so many families I knew had gone there. And we took the other two boys and we drove all around Colorado as much as we could. It's such a huge state. I was just in a dream how easy it was. And there they were in the back seat just chatting about video games, and it was just heaven. Yeah. And then I feel bad about that. But I know that Nat had a great time, yeah. So I guess it was okay.
So don't feel bad. Yeah. All right. So just in the last few minutes we have, we'll talk a little bit about advocating for your kids. And I don't know where you found the time to do all the, because you advocate for lots of people too, Susan. So talk a little bit about how parents can become better advocates for their kids.
Parents have to keep to that list of that they've made, hopefully, when they start to get the vision of what they want for their child, or what they think or what they have found that their child wants in life as an adult. So keep to that list, keep to that vision, and keep honing it as the child changes. Do what you can in terms of saving money, but do it the way Fred is saying. You know, you have to really be aware of the tax laws and the laws and how much money a person can have. So you have to save whatever you can. You have to continue to have community and adult other friends that can help you out, whether with respite or with advice. You know, look at older parents who've been there and talk to them. Talk to everyone. Your state agency person knows so much. You know, try to just get on their radar screen. Write letters to your congresspeople, to your state reps. You know, make them care with just your personal story. You don't have to be an expert. You just have to write to them. Right. They have to care.
I'm just thinking with the IEPs, we talked about individual education plans, and I think it's really hard for parents when your kids are little. It gets easier, it seems to me, as they get older, because you know the game by that point. Right. But in the beginning, it's very overwhelming. You're in there with, you know, a group, and you're like the parents with all these other faces, and it's intimidating. And you, at that point, aren't sure legally what your child is eligible for.
Yeah, one organization the family should know about is the Federation for Children with Special Needs. They provide advocacy training. A very, very experienced lawyer. I'm having a senior moment. I can't remember his name, but he's been doing it for years. And a lot of parents have benefited from the training offered by the Federation for Children with Special Needs in Boston. In terms of advocacy, after a parent is no longer advocating for themselves, people really need to think about setting up a team following their involvement. I know it's hard to think about that. One mechanism is develop cheerleaders, for your family member. And some families we've worked with have created trust advisory committees made up of family members, advocates, friends who know the family's history and meet on a regular basis and advise the special needs trustees. And those have become quite popular for families who have the resources and the connections and have had the time to really think about this. Cheryl Chan is incredibly helpful. We've mentioned her a couple times in helping families through this process about planning.
All right. Fred Misolo, considered one of the nation's elder law and special needs attorneys. He focuses on the area of elder law, special needs planning, estate planning, and trust administration, guardianship, and adult service advocacy. Susan Senator, her latest book, Autism, Adulthood Insights and Creative Strategies for a Fulfilling Life. I also recommend the other two, Making Peace with Autism and the Autism Mom's Survival Guide. Thank you both so much for coming in and talking.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, a pleasure.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.